nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Okay, well, I'll go ahead and get started in the interest of starting on time and finishing on time here. And we'll sort of the same ground rules as last time. They're filming this so that hopefully what you can do is by next week sometime, the first lecture it'll be about a week delay. You can go back and review anything that you want to, where you may want to look at all or part of the lecture. You can go back and do that. It'll be on the NanoHub, and I'll give you the address. So we'll also, if there's things that are absolutely important, you think to stop the lecture and do questions, I can do that. I'm happy to do that. But usually things flow a little more smoothly, and if we save most of the questions to the end, and then what we'll be doing also is filming the questions at the end. So you get to be on camera too. And I'll try to repeat your question so that it goes in. I'm on a mic here. So, okay, I'll go ahead and start then lecture number two. And you've got the handouts. You should always pick up handouts down. I'll put down in front each week. And today what I'm going to do is actually go through a process of actually design, because what I'm trying to have you do is think of this course as we are designing a medical device. And the medical device in this particular case happens to be what we call a drug device combo. And that's actually what its official designation is if you were trying to have something like this approved through the FDA. So we're combining a drug and some kind of a delivery device. It just happens to be a very small device. But it would be similar to, for example, a drug-eluting stent as a medical device. So let's think of it in those terms, and if we do, we then also have, this being an engineering course, one of the things that you're trying to do is to design something, and there's always design trade-offs. And we need to say what are the things that contribute to a good design that solves the problem that we're trying to do, and hopefully some way that is not only effective from a actual treatment, diagnosis and treatment protocol, but also that's cost effective and in the realm of the reasonable and possible, so we don't end up with something that is would cost $10,000 a dose or more. So we'll talk a lot about that to try to make something out of this practical. This lecture will also be very useful because each and every one of you is part of the course. A major part of the course is you're going to design a nanomedical system of your own design for a particular disease of your choice. And I know some of you that's going to be easier for some of you than others, but I will give you some guidelines. We'll talk about it. We'll also have individual meetings about what, if you're having trouble coming up with a project, we'll go through that. But today's lecture is going to be sort of a first pass through about how would we begin to design one of these nanomedical systems and actually come up with a process that you can go through. As part of that, we will talk about this. This is, as I said, it's an engineering course and officially an engineering course, but there's also a lot of science and some medicine with it, and things become not always quite as strict in terms of what's known and what's not known. As an engineering problem, everything is typically known, and you give specifications and you try to live within those specifications. Here, we're setting some of our own specifications. Some of the science is still not very well known, but I'm gonna try to show you where those boundaries are. And I do update this course every year, try to get the latest literature, and today's lecture will be very similar to last lecture, but last year's lecture number two, but In fact, as we go through the course and get much more into things, I'll be picking literature from 2010 and 2011 whenever possible so that you really have a good feel, for what's coming out of the top labs and what is state of the art, this being a graduate level course. So as part of that, we'll talk about, first of all, elements of good design. which is, I think, essentially an overview of some very simple concepts, but things you really should keep in mind. And then how do you actually build a nano device? We talked a little bit last time about self-assembly. And then the challenges of actually how do you drug dose to single cells. And with all of this, and the way I'm going to teach the course is what we call an onion skin approach. I have to teach you a little bit about everything before we get into the very fine details of some of the things. So if it seemed very general last time, it was partly because most of you had no medical background, and trying to come up with why are these things problems? You're trying to solve real world problems, and I have spent a lifetime as a, 27 years as a professor in medical school, so I have a little idea about what goes on in the field of medicine, and try to pose what those problems really are, because some of them you wouldn't necessarily think of as problems. And then in an onion skin approach, we keep peeling off layers of this and try to go deeper and deeper, and we will get quite deeply into specific topics. So you'll get, when we get into discussing very particular things about nanomaterials and surface chemistry and zeta potentials and things like that, we'll get quite deeply into some of these subjects. But for now, we're walking our way into this. So if it seems a little general, it's that way on purpose. I'm scoping out the entire problem first and then going in detail. So you have this. I've also included four papers for you to read, and you should always go to the course website, which you all should know about now, and this PDF document's here already for you to read. And at times, up through today's lecture, I really do expect you to read them all. Sometimes I'm going to have a large list of papers, in which case I will tell you which ones you must read and then suggest that you read other ones depending on your level of interest. And as with any course, and in particularly any graduate course, you'll get out of this just about exactly what you put into it. I mean, if you don't read the papers, it's going to come back and hurt you later on because you're not going to be familiar with how to design these systems. Because in many cases, a lot of fairly clever solutions are in these papers that you can use and reuse as part of your design. So I urge you to read the literature at least quickly, all of the papers, and spend more time on others that I will be sure and tell you about in particular. So let's go into okay, so lecture two, let's talk about some very general principles of good engineering design. And principle number one is not profound. It basically says whenever possible, use a general design that's already been tested. That should be common sense, but you would be surprised that the number of people who have tried making nanoparticle systems and things that have completely ignored what's been out there. And so what I'm trying to do is, first of all, I'll give you this thing in general, but also suggest to you that your common way of looking at this is to say, oh, I'm going to go look and see what nanomedical papers people have published. And what I'm going to tell you is there's another way to look at the problem. That's certainly true, and you should do that. But another way to look at the problem is this, and namely that nature has already achieved many of these designs. You have in your body all kinds of nano systems. And there are a number of things which nature, by the way, has taken many millions of years to do it. So probably they have a head start in many cases, and we should build on that. And so one of the things, for example, biomimicry is a very common technique used in nanomedicine, because there are many things in nature that have been interacting with the human body for literally millions of years, and a lot of these things have been worked out. So it comes from the Greek, meaning life, and mimesis, which is an imitation of life. And as part of this, you take inspiration from the designs to solve a bunch of problems. And I just happened to pick this book out. You're not required to read it. It's just for the general public. But one of the things that I will emphasize a lot, I'm certainly doing it a lot with my group, is emphasizing nature's natural nanoparticle, which is a virus. And there are all kinds of different viruses. The interesting thing about viruses is that many of them have evolved to interact with human cells, and not necessarily always in bad ways. But the thing that we will talk about here is we will effectively make a synthetic virus, totally synthetic, meaning the only things that it's capable of doing are what we designed it to do. And the problem, those of you who are familiar with the use of adenoviruses and other such things in gene therapy know that there are always a lot of nasty problems, largely because when you use real viruses, they have part of their agenda embedded in them that you can't control. And therefore, many of the nasty side effects and problems of adenoviruses have come from that, because only part of that virus are we really controlling. But the part that's important is viruses have learned how to manipulate the host cell machinery, for example, human machinery, human cells, and actually make products. Now, the difference is a virus is going to actually use the human genome and machinery to actually manufacture things that are in the best interest of the virus. What we're going to do is take some of the elements that viruses use to be able to use the host cell machinery, but use them to actually make products that are advantageous for the cell. Now, we can do that in a couple of ways. One is we actually have, and we've done this, and I'm going to show you some things during the course, where we've actually used this for the synthetic virus to actually manufacture things that will kill the regular viruses, so that these synthetic viruses will actually mimic the real virus. And we have something called a Trojan horse effect. Anybody know what a Trojan horse is? All the American students do, probably, but it's from ancient Greek days, where they had a siege going, and the only way to get inside the castle was for the party outside the castle to pretend to walk away, and they built overnight a horse. These were the Trojans. They built a horse and they hid people inside it. And the Greeks brought it in as a gift. Okay, they thought it was a gift, and they brought it in, and then during the night, the people came out from inside this wooden horse and opened the gates and let their own guys in. So it's called a Trojan horse effect. It's been used many, many, many times in medicine. And we actually can make these nanoparticles literally look like a real virus. And we have done that. Our group has done that for hepatitis C, for example, where we've actually coated nanoparticles with the E2 protein that's available on a virus that makes it look like a hepatitis C. And guess what? The particles do exactly. They home to the same organs in the same way as the hepatitis C virus does. The difference is we put an antiviral drug inside the nanoparticle so that it would go to the cells that were infected in the same way, and then destroy the virus, the natural virus. So that's just one example. But it gives you an idea that you can actually make synthetic events and control the order of things. So again, constructing, in this case, what we want to do is we definitely would want to make our synthetic virus non-replicating. Usually people do that in the real world with real viruses by irradiating them so that they're incapable of replication, or doing a genetic modification, and then you can make a very, very well-defined. And when I say that Mother Nature has actually evolved a lot of these designs, and I won't get into religious or teleological viewpoints here, but basically nature did it by trial and error over many, many millions of years. We know that. We can actually walk our way back. There's a whole field of science known as molecular evolution, where you can actually look at where the changes occurred. So it's not necessarily the best design. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is that what nature comes up with is not necessarily the best design. It's just one design that happened to work. It may work well enough, or it may have worked well enough at some previous point in time. It may not be the best solution now. So we take an inspiration with biomimetic procedures for design, but I have a certain amount of human hubris to say that we can learn from nature and actually think about designing something a little better. And we do that a lot. A lot of designs are inspired by nature. So this is something to keep in mind. Learn, but don't feel limited just by the way nature does it. Okay, another principle. Principle two is something that is a good general purpose design means that it's not particularly good for any specific function. Now that may not seem obvious to you, but there are, if we think about the world of drug design, chemists spend many, many years of their lives taking a molecule and then tweaking it to negate a negative effect that design has, to get rid of some side effects or to have a better homing capability. And the problem is it's still one molecule and it's a general purpose molecule, and you can't get a really highly specific function very often. It's very difficult to do that. And so one of the approaches that I'm going to urge you to try, and I think it's an approach, if we really think of this as a device, as a device plus a drug, then you can start saying, well, I can have a device that has many specific components. Each one of those specific components is very well designed to do that one function very, very well, much more so than a general purpose. Or as I say, a general purpose thing means it's not particularly good for anything. Okay, you dilute the design specifics when you try to make a general purpose thing. So we'll do that, and I'm going to show you some of the ways that we have certainly developed nanomedical systems to involve a lot of specific design components to try to do things better, more efficiently. So keep this one in mind. So any nanomedical device must do several things well. First of all, it must target well to the disease cells of interest. If it doesn't do that, then we haven't got much of a benefit of our nanomedical system. The second thing is, one way or another, either we have to have the nanoparticle enter the cell, or we have to have the nanoparticle get close enough to the cell and release drugs so that we get a high local concentration. Those are two things. We will discuss those different approaches. So some kind of a cell entry, either of the nanoparticle complex containing the drug or just the drug. And then I would argue that since we're taking, in general, a nanomedical approach, if we bring the particle inside, as I mentioned to you last time, these nanomedical systems are about 1/1,000,000th the volume of a human cell. So if you think about that, if you just release the drug right at the cell surface and let it go everywhere within a cell, how many drugs do you know that you can dilute 1,000,000-fold and still have them be effective? There are a few, but they're usually highly toxic substances and probably not a great idea to use in your design. But if you think of that cell as a pretty large universe by itself, compared to the nanoparticle, then what you need to do is, once you get it inside this, across the cell membrane, you have to direct it three-dimensionally to where it needs to be inside the cell, whether it be the nucleus, mitochondria, ribosomes, wherever you're, depending on how you have designed this. It's a big world inside a single cell compared to these nanoparticles. So intracellular targeting is very important. That sounds very difficult. It turns out it's not very difficult. There are known amino acid sequences, typically in the range of 5 to 10 amino acids, that are very good at targeting to intracellular organelles. So this can be done. We've done it. Lots of people have done this. So it's relatively easy to get your nanoparticle to a specific subregion of a cell. And then you can examine, we're going to talk about how do you know you've done that? How do you measure that? But that's one of the things that we need to do with any system. And then control drug delivery. That's what our goal is. Our first thing is targeted delivery, but we would like to do something if it's just killing the cell, perhaps inducing an apoptosis inducing peptide into the cell to cause the cell to shut down, and that's sort of our preferred way in general to get rid of disease cells. But if we want to, as I mentioned last time, want to treat chronic diseases, then we have something a little more difficult. We effectively have to set up a situation where we have either a controlled drug release from that nanoparticle inside the cell, And there are some neat things that we can do with nanotechnology to get a very, very level drug release. Or we can have a feedback control mechanism. And I'm going to show you a little further on in the lecture today how we can actually make something under molecular biosensor feedback control switch. And as good engineers, you should always think about feedback control and not having runaway systems that are out of control. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how we can do that. One of the things I'm going to mention, we have all of these functions, and I'm going to show you some conceptual drawings of a sort of a multi-layered nanoparticle. But I want you to recognize before, right up front when I say this, that this doesn't mean that we have to have four different molecules doing this function or four different layers. It says we have four functions we have to do. We have, for example, we did a particular application with a single 6-amino acid long peptide, which actually targeted to a very specific type of human breast cancer cell, took it across the cell membrane, and intracellularly targeted that particle to the nucleus, all with 6 amino acids. Okay, you don't get that very often. That was pretty lucky. But we can do that, sometimes many functions, but that one was particularly unusual to get essentially the first three of these with 6 amino acids on the nanoparticle. Okay, principle number three. And this is something that you may not have thought about before. If you make a multi-layered particle, if you control the order of molecular assembly, you can actually control the order of those specific functions that I had shown you in the previous slide, leading to a programmable nano device. And I know programming, you immediately think computer software. That has nothing to do. The concept of programming is controlling an order of events. So what we can do is, with chemical layers and different molecules, we can actually control a multi-step order of events in some very interesting ways, including putting in error checking in your system. Now, that's a pretty sophisticated concept in drug delivery, that you actually can put in an error checking step so that if it goes to the wrong place, it doesn't deliver the drug. But we can do that. There are ways to do that. So think about the order of assembly here. That's also important. So if we think about this, and again, this is a conceptual multi-layered system, and I would argue that all nanomedical devices, everything you read out in the literature, is of this general design. Sometimes it's only one molecule. I could have shown you a nanoparticle with that one 6-amino acid long peptide that actually had several layers equivalent of this. So this is conceptual. It doesn't mean that it's actual physical. So if we think about controlling the order of events, then if we think about three layers, numbers 1, 2, and 3, we can think about a design that says whereby step number 1, if you were writing a patent, you would actually, and I have written a patent on this, whereby step number 1 must occur before step number 2 can happen, and step number 3 cannot happen unless it's preceded by steps 1 and 2. So you can actually halt the process, and by doing that, you can control the order of events. So let's take that concept a little further. So if we control that sequence of events, then when you actually build these things, things have to happen on these devices from the outside and then going in, because that's the way it's going to interact with different steps in the process. So if we think about that, of things happening from the outside and then effectively going the next layer in and the next layer in, then when you actually construct these, you actually construct them in the reverse order. So the outermost components are the first to be used, the inner components are the last, but if you're actually building it, you start with the inner components and then you add layers. Why do we do that? Because we're doing a thermodynamically driven self-assembly process. So we have to start with material, and then we're going to have the next process come and actually self-assemble the next layer, and then self-assemble the next layer. And we'll get into some pretty interesting issues there about saying, how do we know that the layers actually were successfully put there? We're going to learn that in a later lecture, using some of our nano tools like X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, for example, and other assays so that we actually know that it happened. And sometimes it doesn't happen the way we think it should. So I have a little way to remember that. This is the first shall be last and the last shall be first. So if you think about that in terms of your design. So that's the order. So let's actually start building something from the inside out. So step number one is a choice of core materials. Now, not all nano devices have a core material. People have built nano devices for drug delivery, certainly with liposomes and micelles, things that don't have that. In the course here, in general, what I'm going to do is, because I'm trying to teach you how to build a nano device that is both diagnostic and therapeutic. So if you want to think about it, in general, part of the purpose of a core, there's two purposes of a core material. One is to have a structure to build on, because it's much easier to build something starting on a surface. But the other thing is that you can then use the properties of this core material to actually for detection, number one, or even movement of things. If it's a magnetic material, you can move it around with a magnet. If it's something that is for example, gold, you can use spectroscopy to actually see those in tissue and take advantage of the somewhat unique properties of gold. If you have ferric oxide, and particularly if it's super paramagnetic iron oxide, you can actually not only manipulate it around with a magnet, but it serves as a magnetic resonance imaging contrast agent. So we can see it deeply in tissues, and it serves a diagnostic function. We can also use many other materials such as silica, quantum dots, other things, and build structures. Now, these things are all typically of size. Probably the largest ones that you normally see for cores are on the order of 40 nanometers across. So 40 nanometers here. And the reason is if you're doing an iron oxide, for example, 40 nanometers, it has to be big enough material in there so that if you take a reasonable size magnet, you can actually affect it. As you get things smaller and people have made very, very small, and you know you can make very small gold nanoparticles and quantum dots are typically in the range of 2 to about 10 nanometers plus a biocompatibility layer, so it gets up to maybe about 14 nanometers. It's pretty small, and then you start worrying about how many things can you attach to that. So it becomes a game of how many attachment sites can you actually build the surface chemistry and add these other layers. And I can tell you, when you get down to quantum dots, with say about 14 nanometers across here, if you put functional groups like carboxyl groups or amine groups on there so that you can start attaching antibodies or peptides or other things to that, you quickly get to a point where you may have only 100 possible sites of attachment. So things get pretty crowded on the nanoscale, and you've also got to think about which will be one reason why I will warn you against using antibodies, because while they're quick and easy to use, they're very big and they take a lot of surface territory, and it's hard to add other things. So we'll talk a lot about this, but let's talk first about a core material that gives us something, a structure to build on, that we can build the chemistry on top of this. We can also use the properties of this for imaging and for other diagnostic purposes. Okay, so after we've built that, and again with some attachment sites, the surface chemistry, we're going to have a lecture on surface chemistry, not that this is going to be an all-encompassing lecture, but try to bring out some of the unique things that happen on nanomaterial surfaces. And so here we can essentially then form some kind of an attachment of drugs or therapeutic genes. And when I use the word therapeutic genes, what I'm typically doing is thinking of these therapeutic genes not as genes which integrate stably into the genome of the human cell, because that would be a somatic cell gene therapy, and we're a little bit careful about doing those. But if you think of this as a transient, just another drug that interacts as a type of gene type product. So we put a layer there. We will also want some kind of a sensing material that can be put typically in the same layer so that the sensor interacts with the environment. And that allows a couple of different things. One is the sensor can say, oh, I'm in the wrong place. I have it hooked up in a way that the drug doesn't get released if the sensor doesn't find a particular molecule of interest in the cell. It says, oh, I went to the wrong place. I should stop right here and not release the drug. The other thing that this can do is this can control this. I've shown this thing, and again, this is a schematic, a conceptual thing, but sometimes what we have is a way of giving a controlled release of the drug. And we'll do that actually in a much more sophisticated way by making things like nanopores, which are actually allow one molecule at a time to go through a tunneling structure. Those structures have been built by a number of groups. But this gives us a chance to not only deliver a drug, but in some sense to sense the surrounding environment, to know whether they really should release it, and if it does, to have some kind of maybe a feedback control built in. This is the opportunity to put that in to the design. And in general, as I mentioned last time, medicine usually doesn't have feedback control in the drug delivery system. We can have what we call controlled release, which just means controlling the levels so that they don't spike and vary quite as much. But an actual feedback control is pretty rare. Okay, so the next thing is that I mentioned to you that it's a big world inside a cell, and to just drop the drug off at the surface or outside the cell, as many people do, where they'll make particularly things like liposomes that will release a drug in the vicinity of a tumor. You have the problem that you've got now a drug gradient. You've got to push it across the membrane. That's frequently requires a pretty good drug concentration. And then you have a tough time controlling that. So if we don't want to do that, if we want to actually bring the whole device inside the cell to work from the inside, then we've got to have some kind of across the cell membrane plus intracellular targeting to get it close to where it needs to be. If we need to bring it to the nucleus, we need to bring it to the nucleus, not leave it off at the cell membrane. So there's all kinds of things that you can do. And again, this can be very simple, typically some specific amino acid sequences. Okay, outside step, that's where we target to the cells of interest. This is the part that has to survive in the bloodstream, typically, and it has to survive long enough and not be taken out by the immune system or by the kidneys. And it has to have some kind of a built-in targeting. You don't want it to be immunogenic. When people first started using monoclonal antibodies as therapy in humans, they actually did put mouse monoclonal antibodies, which is how they're normally made, in human beings, and they had some very tragic deaths where people actually went into anaphylactic shock because of the reaction against the mouse proteins that the body. And some people very violently reacted against that. So we'll talk a lot more about, we'll have a whole lecture about the structure of antibodies and peptides and a lot of the specifics. How do you design that to be a specific targeting without activating the immune system and causing a lot of side products that you don't want to happen? But this can be, when you think about this, I've drawn a picture that looks kind of like a typical symbol for an antibody, but I want you to think of that in a much wider context as a targeting molecule. And again, antibodies as possible. It can be a DNA, RNA aptamer, just a sequence, because you can actually make DNA and RNA sequences which recognize shapes like an antibody. You can do a ligand receptor. For example, Phil Lau in chemistry has developed his folate receptor, which is what's used to bind to tumor cells. So that's an example of a ligand receptor model. Peptides are very, well, you can make peptides that recognize the same shape sequences that a big antibody would do. And the peptides can be quite small. Like I mentioned, as small as 6 amino acids, that's a pretty small peptide to have the same kind of targeting as an antibody would. So here's what the whole structure looks like. Again, you rarely see that in the literature except in articles that my group has published, but I would argue that everything that you see in the literature is some form of a multi-layered, even if it's one layer. And a lot of them are two or three layers, but they just don't tell you that. But you should be thinking as you read through that, how did they do that? Because they have to go through the same process. How did they actually manage And conceptually, you should always come up with something that looks like this. Although it may be, say, one molecule may do two or three of these things. And the other thing is, you say we built this. Now, it turns out that a harder thing than building it is having that complex, this nanomedical device, do what it's supposed to do when it gets inside the body. It's circulating around. Maybe it goes to the right place. Maybe it goes to the wrong place. But what you want it to do is when it goes to the right place, you want it to effectively delayer, to take off a layer and go to the next one. Because by doing that process, then you get this process of programmed activity where you're actually controlling a sequence of events, because the second step can't happen until it's somehow released from the first step. So at this, there's lots of different ways that can happen. Quite often, this antibody layer can be also, we will put around it, for example, we'll talk much more about this in another lecture, but part of the process of having it circulate for a long time in the bloodstream, we quite often put what we call a stealth layer, S-T-E-A-L-T-H, that'll allow it to go around in the bloodstream for a long period of time and not be taken out. And the most common one that people use, you'll see a lot of this in the literature, is polyethylene glycol complexes. And those ones, what happens with a polyethylene glycol complex that has these antibodies embedded into it, when it comes up and grabs a hold of the receptor, the polyethylene glycol and the lipid membrane will fuse. And so this layer will disappear, and you will then, and in many cases, depending on what the molecule is, you pull it across the membrane, and the first layer is now missing, and the second layer is there. So it's not as mysterious as it sounds. It really can be done. In some cases, you have to get much more elaborate. You have to have an enzymatic cleavage or have a layer come off because it gets into an acidic environment. And that's a very common procedure used to delayer, to get rid of part of the structure of a nanoparticle to get to the next layer. So the process is, as we go through from binding the cell, now we've gone inside the cell, and now we have this structure, and then with the drug and the biosensor controls, and then what we try to do is design something that is not only biocompatible, but biodegradable. Now that's, you will see people put things like gold nanoparticles because gold is thought to be somewhat biocompatible, but at some point, if you put enough gold into a tissue or organ, it's going to be toxic. So the best idea is to have something, and in particular, we do a lot in my lab with ferric oxide, because the iron is just broken down. And basically the cells eat it. In fact, many of you eat it in your vitamin pills or your food supply as a source of iron. So it's a very simple structure. It breaks down very, very well. And in fact, your desired thing is that when people say, well, what happens to the nanoparticles when, after they've done their thing? And I say, well, they go away. Now, I have had questions and I've thought about it a bit. People say, well, wouldn't it be easier if you just made a nanoparticle that would travel from cell to cell? And I say, well, yeah, viruses do that and other things. But the problem is, if you have the same particle doesn't get degraded and it goes from cell to cell, you have to ask yourself the next question, how do you make it stop? It may go to, and if it's not perfect, it makes enough errors. If it goes from cell to cell, it could cause an awful lot of damage. So when I think about design on this, I prefer to make a design that not only do I control it well, but I make the thing effectively self-destruct when it's through. Then I know I've made a safe structure and that I'm not going to cause some problem. Because even if it doesn't replicate itself, I mentioned to you, think about this like an artificial synthetic virus. Even if it doesn't replicate itself, if it goes from cell to cell, it could conceivably cause a lot of damage. See, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that, but you want to be really thinking about it before you put something like that in your design. So here's the whole process. If you think about targeted drug gene delivery, is that you have this nano device. It comes in. It's got the first step of targeting to the cell. It has to bind to something, and we'll talk about why that's true, because electrically we always try to put something so that this doesn't just non-specifically stick all over everything. We're going to talk a lot about that because the so-called zeta potential is the primary mechanism by which nanoparticles interact with cells. And we have to design the proper zeta potential, and you're going to learn how to do that, so that it only binds to this receptor when it's a specific interaction, and that interaction actually sort of pulls it across the potential, electrical potential barriers. That way it doesn't, it makes it not stick all over everything. And then you have something come through the cell membrane, typically losing a layer in the process. And I mentioned to you, typically what happens is this layer ends up becoming part of the cell membrane. It just redistributes in the lipid bilayer. And then you release a particle from the other side. It may go into an endosome. We're going to talk more about that later. Or we may just target that if we have it escape the endosome. Let's say we want it to go to the nucleus. There are many so-called nuclear localization sequences, amino acid sequences, to take it to the vicinity of the nucleus where it can also interact. And then there's some interesting things here, because if you actually had to have it go inside the nucleus, we also know that if you get beyond about 10 to 14 nanometers diameter, that particle's not going to go inside. So there are some very particular strategies. First of all, you can think about making it very small at that point, or you can have this actually a collection. I've shown this schematically as one thing, a collection of smaller ones hidden inside a larger one that are released. And it's very similar to the process of having for example, a lunar lander vehicle goes down on the surface from the orbiting one. Okay, so we have our one out here orbiting, and then it lets smaller versions of actually controlling the drug that are small enough to actually go through the nucleopores of the typical nucleus. So there's lots of different strategies for doing this. Okay, so the general strategy, and I mentioned to you last time, why are we doing this? We're doing this because we're trying to do optimal drug delivery without to the right cell, so targeted drug delivery, without the side effects. And we're able to, by delivering something that has the drug inside it, then and targeted, hopefully other parts of the body, other tissues and organs are not going to be exposed to the drug, and we can cut the dose down if we can increase the circulation time. So our goal, and I think it's a very realistic goal, is to even take existing drugs and reduce the amount of exposure dosage to each person by at least a factor of 10 times. If we can do that, we will eliminate a lot of the side effects right there. And that, I think, is a very realistic goal. I've seen far greater than that. I've seen 20, 30 times the amount of drug delivery. Okay, and I'm going to just, again, sort of maybe a futuristic, more of a wow type thing. But if you start thinking about the drug delivery problem, you also start thinking about, well, why are we delivering a drug? Isn't it possible, particularly if you think about some kind of for example, a therapeutic peptide, the cell is quite capable of manufacturing peptides. It does it all the time. It has all the machinery in place. The only thing that it really doesn't know how to do is it doesn't know what order to put endogenous RNA and DNA precursors. It doesn't know which order to put them in. So what if we gave it a template, a single-stranded template of RNA or DNA, that it would know from the complementary sequence idea about how to organize those things in the proper order. So if you start to think about that, you say, wow, if I can do that, then I'm no longer delivering a drug. I'm delivering a drug manufacturing capability. This sounds like science fiction. We and other groups have already done this. It's quite doable. And the neat thing about it is you can also attach a nice upstream from the gene sequence, an upstream molecular biosensor switch, which will actually control in a feedback loop the actual production of that therapeutic peptide. So that's a pretty neat thing, because then you're not putting a lot of drug into a person, and in fact you can design it so that it never ever even turns on unless it finds its target molecule inside the cell. So it's a permanently off unless it has something that actively turns the switch on. And that has some some really neat idea ramifications. So if inside here we actually make a template, and it doesn't really look like this, this is a schematic, obviously, but we have some kind of a switch, we have a gene manufacturing capability by a single-stranded template, and then we start thinking about this in terms of a feedback loop against, something missing here. I have to swap the slide out. There's actually a molecule here which then will, that's inside the disease cell, which will sit on the molecular biosensor switch and turn this on. And when, and the effect of this peptide is to knock down the concentration of that protein, typically a protein, but it can be something else inside here. And when it knocks it down, then it's going to stop coming over here, binding to the switch, and then the switch goes off. So that gives you the idea, not only manufacturing it under feedback control, but potentially, I'm not saying this is easy, but potentially making something which could treat chronic diseases and actually turn on. And then if the cell started to becoming diseased again, it could actually turn this thing on and keep doing it in loops. And that may be very important, particularly for somatic cell treatment. Okay, can that be done? So the answer is, here's an actual example. So here's the schematic of that. The first question you should ask yourself, can I build a structure? So we actually built structures with this, with, in the first case, a cytomegalovirus promoter region here and a particular a reporter gene called DSRED. And then these poly-A basically act like a transactivating sequence, which will then use the host cell machinery to actually manufacture this. The second example is an actual molecular biosensor hooked to an enhanced green fluorescent protein. And again, that would actually accomplish this. Now, you need to ask yourself, you say, if I put one of these sequences on a nanoparticle, do I have to release it from the nanoparticle? I mean, that's one strategy. Or can I actually tether it to the surface of the nanoparticle and actually get efficient reading of that gene sequence? And the answer is we've done successful tethering of this sequence on the superparamagnetic iron oxide particles. And you can see from the green in here, we've actually gotten a good expression of that reporter gene. And if you can do a reporter gene, you can do just about anything else. A small peptide would be quite reasonable to do. Now, let me go back here. So two examples are the DSRED is this one here where the switch is always on. So that was the easy one to make, saying if we have our switch on all the time and it goes in, it will just sit there and make more of this DSRED reporter gene. The hard one is the one with the upstream molecular biosensor, and we made that a biosensing switch which was sensitive to reactive oxygen species proteins inside the cell. Now that starts to become important because there are many human diseases that are characterized by generation of reactive oxygen species proteins. So we're starting to get in the realm of something actually useful with that sensor. And in this particular case, this is actually one where the switch was turned on in this feedback loop where we stress the cells, produce these reactive oxygen species, and the particles are here, and we actually generated all of the green fluorescent protein that's inside there. And that green fluorescent protein could, in fact, be a small, and it could be a very small, maybe even a 10 to 20 amino acid peptide that had therapeutic effect. So this is all very reasonable to be able to expect that you can do this. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about, I talked last time about how in a typical hospital, and I think this is pretty much the same around the world, you typically have the diagnostics and pathology in one side of the hospital, and you have the therapeutics in another part. And Abby, am I correct in that? Okay. And they don't always talk efficiently to each other. Sometimes they do. She's shaking her head and smiling. Having been in pathology, I know that they don't, and also in a clinical department, internal medicine, I know that they don't necessarily always talk well together. So we have a gap there just by separating the functions and by separating the people. So one of the things that we can also accomplish in these nanomedical devices is we can bring diagnostics and therapeutics together literally in the same device. And that will make, will help bridge this gap. People will start thinking of diagnostics and therapeutics together rather than separately. And this new approach that we'll see this word over and over again, the original word was theragnostics, which is a combination of therapeutics and diagnostics. And now many people, it's getting more common in the literature to drop the G and have theragnostics. But you'll see that word more and more as an approach which is doing both diagnostics and therapeutics. And that's relatively new to medicine. Now, is this something that is just out of the imagination, or is it actually, are pharmaceutical companies starting to think about this? And the answer is this actually came from a 2007, and this was a company, a French company, that was linking up with basically the MIT, Harvard, Cambridge backyard of high tech, and actually coming up in Kendall Square, where that is. I used to live near there. Actually thinking about building theragnostic nanomedicine devices. And so this has been happening for several years, and that Biomérieux is actually a fairly serious French pharmaceutical firm. One of my former graduate students works there now. So what I want to do now is say again, how do we have a feeling that some of this stuff will work, and why is it not quite as major a departure from what we're doing right now as you might think? And what I'm going to do is basically present this as I did when I gave an invited talk to the FDA about how they should think about nanomedical systems. I said, well, you know, you've already approved. In 1997, the FDA in America approved the first anti-cancer antibody in the United States. It was against non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And it's a very, very common one. It's actually going generic, I think, in the next year or two. So it's, this particular, the original one is called Rituxan or Rituximab. And whenever you see a name which has a mab on the end, that really stands for, MAB is for monoclonal antibody. So that's telling you something about all these are this is small monoclonal antibody. This one is a small molecule when you have an IB here at the end. So it's not quite the same. But so this is more of the ligand receptor model, like Phil Lau's folate receptor, for example. So what you have is a series of antibodies that you've put in. Now remember my statement about how when you put an antibody or you put a molecule in, you try to make it general purpose to do everything. The problem is it doesn't do some things well. And one of the problems is when you put these antibodies, now these are so-called humanized sequences of mouse monoclonal antibodies where they've traded sequences, tried to reduce the allergic reaction, and we're going to talk in great detail about how we actually do that. But these monoclonal antibodies, they put them into the bloodstream, and the problem is in your bloodstream you have cells called neutrophils which go around looking for foreign objects, and they gobble them up. And the problem is that when they take these antibodies and they gobble them up, two things happen. First of all, they probably destroy 95% of the antibody you put in. And I can tell you, it's about $5,000 a dose on a patient, on one patient. Now you're destroying 95% of it, which meant that you had to have 20 times as much material. It's very costly stuff, right? So what if you could start out by reducing that $5,000 by a factor of 20 or even 10? So you've gone from $5,000 down to $500. That's huge, okay? The second thing is, because you've killed, those neutrophils have eaten those antibodies, they've also become very ill. And what happens is it starts destroying the neutrophils in the person, and then the person becomes susceptible to infection. And patients have been known to die of infection. So now what do? Now you give them a hematopoietic blood hormone to try to get it, the bone marrow to produce more neutrophils to fight the potential infections from the fact that you put an antibody in and you didn't protect it. So if you look at this, you say, okay, that looks like I've told you all the things that are wrong with it. Now I'm going to tell you what's right about it. If you compare a patient on chemotherapy with a patient doing rituximab, it is an entirely different world. In chemotherapy, you're going to be destroying all dividing cells, including the gut, the stomach, and intestinal linings, which is why cancer patients used to die before intravenous feeding because they couldn't eat anything, couldn't hold anything down. They call cancer the wasting disease because you just couldn't take any kind of nourishment. So intravenous feeding and IV made people able to survive chemotherapy. But then your hair falls out. You're really feeling sick. It destroys part of your bone marrow, and you're susceptible again to infections and other things. It's a pretty nasty thing, and those are literally poisons that are designed to kill cells, typically kill dividing cells. That's about the only advantage it has. But the other things that are dividing cells that are important in your body is your entire gastrointestinal tract is susceptible to chemotherapeutic drugs, as is your bone marrow. Those are two things you don't want to lose. So people have a very high quality of life with this and are less at risk to infections and other diseases when they take this. So this has been miraculous. We started with rituximab in 1997. There are approximately 20, and I'll look that up to see if there's any been approved in this last year before the lecture. But there are about 20 different types of cancer that you can largely control or even effectively cure. When I say cure, we'll use that word loosely because I'm not sure anybody ever gets cured of cancer, but we knock the cancer cell load down enough so your immune system handles it. And oh, by the way, the chemotherapy destroys a lot of your immune system. Why would you want to destroy the immune system in a sick patient? You know, that's a pretty dumb thing to do. So this has a lot of things going for it. And what I'm saying is now, what if we could make this a little better? What if we could effectively target but protect it from being eaten by the neutrophils by putting a stealth layer on, for example, with our polyethylene glycol, have it circulate longer so we can lower the dose, so we can probably lower the overall dose by at least 10 times from what we're putting in here, which should reduce the cost considerably, and the amount of side reactions. We're not going to kill neutrophils in the patient. So the next logical extension, I say, of antibody therapy for cancer should be a nano device having similar things in it. The other thing that this has that they don't tell you about these antibody ones, for example, rituximab, is that you require the patient to have a good functioning immune system. Now, I can tell you what they do is typically give the patient both chemotherapy and antibody therapy, and guess what happens? They knock the immune system down, so then the immune system isn't there that needs to interact with this antibody to cause the actual destruction of cancer cells. And we'll talk about in detail how that's actually done. So that's another thing. Why would you want to destroy the immune system that you need to interact with this? That's not a very good policy. And it's mainly because oncologists have been doing this for 40 years and they don't know of anything else. So it's not a very wise strategy. Now they're just starting in the last 2 or 3 years to actually remove the chemotherapy and just give patients straight rituximab, and it's taken them that long to give up, go away from their precious poisons of 40 years and give them up, and they're finding that they're getting just as good or better results just giving the rituximab and skip the chemo. So again, my take-home message, since everybody in this room is probably at some point in your life or your family, a loved one, is going to have cancer. If you live long enough, you're going to have probably some type of cancer. The first thing that you should check is there an antibody? First of all, is there an antibody against that cancer? Because these antibodies are coming out now every year, new ones. And then hopefully the next stage beyond that is making a little better device than the antibodies alone. But you want to look at that first before you go through traditional chemotherapy. You may have to if there's no antibody available. That may be all you've got. But this requires knowing how to tag, how to reach those targeted cells. This particular one looks for CD20, which is a particular molecule on these B cells in this lymphoma, and it tags onto that. Unfortunately, CD20 also destroys a lot of other lymphocytes, which are normal lymphocytes and not cancerous. So you end up with a patient that has very little capacity to actually do a an immune system, because these B cells eventually, the normal ones, should progress to making plasma cells and releasing antibody. So it leads to some very interesting problems. You know how you take your yearly flu shot? If you have a cancer patient on rituximab, they have to schedule very, very carefully, because this wipes out all mature B cells, and you have to time the time of your flu shot so that you can actually develop immunity and have your immune system actually produce some antibodies so that you actually get some protection. So I can tell you that that's a real trick to be able to try to get that to work in a patient. So I'm just laying out a few of these, the drug testing and therapeutics, and I'll update this a little bit more, and it's in the paper that I gave you as a reference. You can read more about that. So combinations of therapeutic drugs and diagnostic devices. I mentioned to you that at the very beginning that one of the reasons for putting some kind of a core and typically some kind of nanomaterials was to be able to have it interact with, in a diagnostic way, with various imaging modalities. And so the imaging modalities that it's very easy to divine a nano device that will interact with are, a lot of these nanomaterials are X-ray. They're electron dense, so they're X-ray contrast agents, so they can be used for example, for better mammography. Mammography has serious problems. We'll talk about that more later in the course. But by nanoparticles, we can actually, about 30% of women, mammography is absolutely useless because they have fibrous tissue and they can't tell the difference between a tumor and normal cells. We can enhance that with X-ray contrast agents made out of nanoparticles. MRI contrast agents, we can go from, with a 3 Tesla magnet approved for human use now in the United States, about the smallest tumor you can have is on the order of 0.5 centimeter in diameter. And if you can put a contrast agent on it, we can see things down to about 1 millimeter. So you say, that doesn't sound like very much, but you got to cube that figure. So we're talking about it's basically at least 10 times fewer tumor cells that you're able to detect, which is earlier, a lot earlier. And I mentioned to you last time, you can't typically feel, even if it's on near the surface of the skin, by the time you feel something, it's already very large. So with MRI contrast agent nanomaterials, we can get things down below what you can palpitate and feel and get down about 10 times fewer tumor cell detection. You can also put in PET scanning probes. We'll talk about that later. That gets a little expensive, and we get, as far as I know, most of our PET scan probes that are here that we use in Lafayette. We have a PET imaging center here for the local hospitals, and that stuff usually comes down from Chicago. Indianapolis IU School of Medicine actually has its own cyclotron, so they actually make their own materials for that. So they have some very unique capabilities down there. We'll learn a little bit more about that. And then in vivo optical imaging. Now, people do that a lot for animal imaging and mice, and you can see it on the surface of skin type things. But if that's all it did, it would be very limiting. But now we can start thinking about actually fluorescence-guided surgery. So we can actually light up tumor cells so the surgeon can actually see them. And any of you have done anybody done any surgery here? Either animal or human? Okay. You know, sometimes it's not easy to see the margins of a tumor. And in fact, usually you can see only the larger ones, and that's why surgeons will typically, the margin is saying if the tumor is here, and I'm not quite sure I may cut something this big around a tumor that looks that big because I have no idea where the tumor ends because I can't see it. Whereas this may be entirely free and I might have a smaller tumor here or out here and I can't even see it. So we can enhance that with optical imaging, which during surgery, now you're removing a lot of the layers so that you don't have to transmit through a lot of skin. And all of this, if we guide it with targeted molecules, is in the field of molecular imaging. And that's what we should be trying to do in nanomedicine. So very quickly, just showing you some things here. This is a normal CAT scanner. So we're taking an X-ray, but now we're taking it from various images and reconstructing a three-dimensional view of this. Again, these nanomaterials, most of them are electron dense, so they can produce contrast. MRI contrast agents, we can do a variety of probes. Traditionally, things like gadolinium have been used. It's a positive so-called T1 contrast agent. But it's the traditional forms of that are being banned because it causes severe kidney problems. Iron oxide is a T2 contrast agent. The only problem with that is it's a negative image, so it's a little tricky to deal with, but we're going to look at those a little later. Positron emission has the advantage that you can actually make a molecule which acts metabolically. So quite often, some of these are, for example, put on glucose, so they can actually look at the glucose uptake, and quite often tumor cells are very metabolically active, and so they will light up. You can actually see the metabolically active cells. Not always, we'll learn about that, not always the tumor cells. There are other things that are active also in your body if you get an infection. And the optical imaging, and we'll actually pay a visit to the optical imaging facility over at Binley as part of this course and try to see, I'll make a special arrangements for that so you can learn how to image, and we do a lot of that in my lab. And you can take that optical imaging and go down to subcellular level. And the neat thing we're doing right now is we're making what we call hybrid nanoparticles. One of my students, Jaehong Ki, is making magnetic resonance imaging contrast agents with iron oxide core, and he's also using near-infrared fluorescence imaging probes. And that allows us to go basically over four orders of magnitude in size, all the way down from about a millimeter in size down to subcellular. So we can actually look inside individual cells with the same particles. So there's a lot of different things we can do. There are some cheap and easy ones, making your own. Once you know how to make them, iron oxide particles are pretty cheap and easy to make. If you buy them, they're very, very expensive to use in any kind of quantities. PET probes are inherently expensive because they're very short-lived. If you have a facility like at IU School of Medicine, that might make some sense. It's a little bit harder to do here at Purdue. And then making very, very cell-specific probes. So we don't have to make one device that does both diagnostic and therapeutics. And sometimes it makes more sense to design something that takes advantage of unique properties so that you don't have to put it in the same device, but in some cases that allows you to localize. Otherwise, you may have things going to slightly different locations, and the diagnostics and the therapeutics get a little mixed. And these are the four references that I've given you. The last one was by one of my graduate students. One of our very first papers, actually, that we published in nanomedicine, which actually had the biosensor-controlled gene therapy. So that was back a little bit in time. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. And we've still got 5 minutes or so. Yeah?
For the nano factories device, I see that you have the examples of you had those... you make the cells all the fluorescence with the green and the red.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, like, this is basically zooming out one cell, the fluorescent green and the fluorescent red, but, like, what is the overall efficiency of this process? Like how many cells do actually get infected and does the job?
If you have the, so the question is basically looking at the one, the slide about the reporter genes and the manufacturing of the drug inside individual cells. His question is, since I've zoomed in on one cell, the logical question is saying, well, how efficient is that? And that's a very good question to ask, because we know that when we read scientific papers, when people give a representative cell, it translates to meaning the best one I ever saw. Okay. So they're not all that good, but it's much, much higher than a traditional transfection frequency, because the nanoparticles, really can be with very high efficiency. We're talking 80, 90% or more, targeted to the cells. So you can get a very high, not all of them, were in the same efficiency in terms of the production of the green fluorescent protein in there, but the actual delivery and efficiency of delivery was much, much higher than you would get with a normal transfection event. Excellent question. Yes?
Is the fluorine toxic to the cell, or have any other
unfine effects? Okay. And this particular follow-up question for the same event, is the fluorescence toxic to the cell? These particular probes that we're using, particularly green fluorescent protein, actually is a protein from jellyfish. And the answer about its toxicity in the individual cell is that unless you get an awful lot of it produced in a cell, the human cells don't seem to mind this. If you really, really put a lot of green fluorescent protein, at some point it will become toxic, but you need a lot of it. That's why people use this, because it really doesn't perturb the cell function, in many cases by any measurable way, by normal metabolic functions, even looking at pathways and other things. So people have been using, some of these. And I showed you green fluorescent protein, but they have done, mutations of those sequences to get all kinds of different colors. And, one of the original inventors of that, Roger Chen, was the, got the Nobel Prize recently for green fluorescent protein and its color variants. You can do this in there's probably at least a dozen different colors you can do. So that makes it nice, because you can study more than one thing at once and actually look for simultaneous, are two or three things happening simultaneously in a cell. You can study that with different colors of reporter. And they're all known as reporter genes, because there's actually a DNA sequence, a very small DNA sequence, which will actually produce the fluorophore in that color. And they just snip that out of the jellyfish and put it into a vector, and it's really easy to use. And we've made our own. We've actually done a number of different colors. Good question. You can. Nobody else has one yet, so.
In fact, the ideal drug has many layers.
Yeah.
This layer should be synthesized for many steps. So, what's the percentage of the ideal drug after the final synthesis of the whole drug?
What is the? Are you asking about what is the efficiency of encapsulation of drug, or are you asking about what is the efficiency of all nanoparticles having all the same layers in the right places? The second? Okay. So the question is, when you make these multi-layered nanoparticles, how do I know, and what is the efficiency of getting all of the nanoparticles with all of the layers in the right place? And that's an excellent question, because if each of those, if the outermost layer determines the sequence, if you're missing a layer, then it's going to skip a level of the programming, right? So you have to ask yourself, with what efficiency am I making? Is it 90%, 80%, 99% that has the right sequences, or did I miss a step? So the only way that you can do that is you can actually perform tests on aliquots of the nanoparticles and look at what is in the outermost layer. That's the easiest way to do it. And one way that we do that is we use a what I call a nano tool called X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, which will examine only the outermost layers, unless you go up to some place like Fermilab and use their synchrotron, and then you can go probe a little deeper. But here at Purdue, we have X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy available as a service and available to you over in the Burke Nanotechnology Center, and we use that, and it will tell you not only molecules, but it will also tell you if you formed bonds. So let's say you think you formed a covalent bond with your antibody or your peptide coming up against an amine or a carboxyl group. So we can actually look for specific bonds to see, did that really happen? So the answer is, this is a very serious issue because you have to do it efficiently enough that you don't make mistakes. Has anybody really geared it up and looked at it very closely? And the answer is, to the best of my knowledge, no. And quite often in a manufacturing process, if it's not possible to manufacture with, and it's important to get it a faithful process, then you have to have some process of cleaning up what you've done. And that could be done conceivably with things like affinity columns and other things to get rid of the ones that are defective. But yes, we know that we make some defective nanoparticles, but we don't have good statistics of what that is and seeing what that is from process to process. If you start gearing it up for manufacture, you bet we're going to have to know exactly what the efficiency and how good is good enough. Because no process has to be perfect, but there's a consequence of making a mistake or missing a layer. You know, what is the consequence? In some cases, the consequence may be nothing. It just means that there's a lowering efficiency of that. But that doesn't mean that it's going to have a bad effect. Another one, it may skip a number of effects, go to the wrong cells, and that would be a very serious effect. Other questions? Yes. Okay, so the question, as I understand it, is again follow up from the previous one. If there's a defective particle, will it inside human beings have some bad effects on the
layer? Because you have multiple layers, right?
Yes.
And nanomedicine go through the cells, the layers will peel off, but you cannot guarantee that. Whenever you go each step, the outermost layer will peel off completely.
Yes. Okay. So her question is that when you're delayering these nano devices, you can't guarantee that all of the layers come off. What I would argue is that there are multiple consequences for that. The first consequence would be that it would be like a error checking, the equivalent of an error checking when it got to the right place, but it acted like it got to the wrong place and then it didn't do anything. So it would be a lowering of the efficiency of drug delivery. That would be the first thing that you would see. Would it go to the wrong, a more serious one would be, would it go to the wrong place? And if it went to the wrong place and then had a different effect, that would be more serious. Why am I concerned about going to the wrong place? We know that, surprisingly, human beings don't have very many specific genes. Surprisingly small number. And the reason is that for example, proteins at different places inside a cell have totally different functions. So if we deliver, let's say we were to deliver the nanomedical device to the wrong place inside a cell, then we might interact with proteins not that had the function that we were trying to interact with, but a totally different function. And so therefore, I mean, that's one that you wouldn't normally think about. And most people don't think about it, but I think it's a very important one. There's a whole field called locational proteomics, where people are actually starting to study where inside a cell particular proteins are, and they find that there are totally different functions for the same protein when it's in different parts of the cell. So that's why if a layer, particularly for an intracellular targeting layer, were not in the right place, then conceivably you could go to attack that same protein in a different part of a cell. I don't think that that's likely to be a huge problem, but I think it's one that we need to pay attention to. Other questions? Well, since our time is up, what I'll do is be happy to stay and answer a few questions while I'm getting myself out of the way for the next class to begin here. But I'm happy to answer more questions. And you can always feel free to email me with questions and things, too. That's a good way. That way, when it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you can email me a question, and I don't have to answer it at 3 a.m., but I can do that when I get your message. So I don't guarantee to answer your questions at 3 a.m.